This is writer and game designer Robin D. Laws.
And this is game designer and writer Kenneth Height.
And this is our podcast, Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff.
Bandwidth brought to you by Pelgrane Press.
Stuff we're going to talk about in this episode include...
opening scenario beats.
The Elgin Marbles.
The Kid.
And Athanasius Kerker.
Big news from Mission Control. If you missed out the first time, don't panic. The wait is over. The Catstronauts board game is finally back in stock at Atlas Games.
That's right. Catstronauts sold out almost immediately on release, but the reprint has officially landed. Now you can finally bring the kitty crew home to your tabletop.
And just in time, too, because things are getting interesting on the International Space Station.
Giant laser pointers in space and a live stream of nose boops? What's not to like? Let's check out how the Catstronauts are doing up there.
Oh man, there goes Waffles the pilot. He's off to see how many kibble bits can achieve orbit around his belly. A pioneer in snackodynamics, that cat.
Careful, Waffles. If the other Catstronauts catch you clogging the air filters with crumbs again, it's back to litter box duty for you.
Look at them working together. Waffles is keeping the station steady. Pom Pom is swatting at fasteners like feather toys. And Major Meowser is... napping on the instructions.
Teamwork at its finest. You can lead this kitty crew yourself in the official Catstronauts board game.
It's a cooperative challenge featuring pawsome art by the comics creator Drew Brockington, and it's perfect for gamers of all ages.
But remember, the first printing disappeared at light speed. Don't let this reprint of Catstronauts slip through your claws.
Secure your copy today at atlas-games.com/catstronauts. That's atlas-games.com/catstronauts.
Let us begin in the preamble hut, where we talk about something else before getting into the main meat of the podcast. And this time around, we have an exciting announcement. Things are changing. Things are different. Ken, you and I are going on a different journey to the UK this year because we will be at Tabletop Scotland, which happens from the 4th to 6th of September in Edinburgh. And we will not be going to Dragon Meet this year. Pelgrane is shifting its UK convention focus to Tabletop Scotland. That's a decision that is not taken lightly. We know that a lot of you expect us to be there in London, as we have for so many other years.
We just hope the Treadwells will be able to get by. That's our real concern.
Yeah, so really we're saying this now so that if you're in Edinburgh and you're planning to open an occult bookstore, have that open for Ken by the beginning of September.
Yeah.
So once again, we'll be at Tabletop Scotland from the 4th to 6th of September, and that will be in place of our usual trip to Dragon Meet.
The rattle of dice, the thump of miniatures, the crunch of Doritos, and the benevolent gaze of Peter Frampton coming alive welcome us once more to the gaming hut, and once more we are on the windswept battlements of Elsinore Castle. Well, maybe we're not on the battlements, because we're probably down in the barbican, the way you get into the castle. Sure, the play opens on the battlements, but the castle opens at the barbican. So let's go there. It's out of the wind. The Doritos won't blow around, and we can deal with the opening moments of a scenario with our traditional GM, not the GM screen of Peter Frampton coming alive, but the GM screen of the melancholy Dane himself, Hamlet's GM screen. And we're talking up and down beats for the very opening part of the scenario. And Robin, you wrote this, so you probably know what we're doing.
Right. And we're talking about this in the context, of course, of Hamlet's GM screen, my new book, available from Pelgrane Press. As we record this, the pre-orders are underway. It should be a short trip to the printers and back, because it's a very simple, perfect bound book. You can already pick up the electronic versions. And if this were a scenario of Hamlet, not one run by Hamlet, it would have exactly take place on the battlements, because that's where he gets his mission.
Mm-hmm.
The ghost tells him what to do. And so we're talking about analyzing the opener of a scenario, how you get into it. And traditionally, we're used to in passive media, we've kind of gone past the opening scene that is just the detective or the spy or the superhero just getting an assignment from their superior. But in a game where you're assigning a clear mission, that actually works pretty good and has more variance in it and is less of sitting passively and listening to a lecture than it would be in more traditional media, because the players can ask questions and they can engage in dialogue. And so your trick as a game master is simply to leave space for people to ask questions. So you may be considering a big, long opening PowerPoint presentation from M or Mr. Johnson or whoever it is, but rather find a way to engage the players and have them react to it. And they can supply beats of their own when they pose a question. That is a downbeat, a tension-creating beat. When you supply an answer, that is a tension-relieving beat. And there's also all sorts of opportunity for players to throw in riffs. If they're worried about how dangerous the mission is and say so, that's a downbeat. If they're confident and sure they can take this on and a rugged spirit of adventure, that's an upbeat. If they're overconfident and worryingly prepared for the circumstances, that might be a mixed beat or possibly just a straight up down beat. But if you leave room for queries, if you get a very simple version of the mission out and then let the players ask questions, you're opening it up into a scene that has all of that classic rhythm of an engaging narrative.
Which implies that if you're doing the classic voice on a tape or you found a mysterious letter or whatever, it's ideal to keep that short. And if you're doing another thing where you might think, well, we can't question it, you're doing your uncle's will, he left you the haunted house, open in the lawyer's office so you can ask the lawyer questions and the lawyer will know some parts of the scenario and maybe other parts he won't know. And maybe some parts, being a lawyer, he'll be sketchy or shifty about. And so that will add juice and excitement, right? I guess that's the right summary. If it's on the tape, keep it fast, dissolve it in 5 seconds, cut to the opener, right?
Right. And if it has to be a setup where you can't interact with the letter or the tape or what have you, you can have the mission itself pose a question. And so frame it so that rather than saying, the dungeon is over here, go there, that's an imperative. That's sort of interesting. That implies action. That could get people excited. But even more interesting is find out what is in the dungeon. Turn the mission into a question. Similarly, if you say, go to the alien base, sure, that's great. That raises a question. What kind of aliens there are? That's kind of interesting. Even more interesting is find out how we can defeat the aliens, right? That's another question. How do we defeat the aliens? Or the mission itself may already contain an implicit question and not need you to hammer that on the head. For example, go and steal these precious diamonds. That immediately poses the question, what is the security system like? Whose diamonds are they? Who will come after us if we steal the diamonds? And so again, you're getting into a back and forth and you're beginning already to set the problem solving of the mission in mind. And that's an example where the mission leads immediately to thought. If there is a sequence where the characters, you know, have to traverse across a frozen wasteland or through a desert, the first problem that they encounter will be the problem of travel. And next week we'll talk about the shift from receiving the mission to beginning to deal with obstacles. And we'll get into that sort of thing in a bit more detail.
So one of the ways that we do deal with travel is to ignore it and start at the exciting end instead of the harrowing middle. And so you've already traveled across the desert. You're grimy. You're thirsty. You're sun leathered. And now you have been attacked by the gnolls at the opening of the dungeon. And so you're opening up in combat with the gnolls. Roll for initiative. And that, in addition to avoiding the question of how do we make a travel scene interesting, starts the mission on a immediate question beat. Are we going to beat these gnolls, right?
Right. And that's a procedural beat. That is a problem that you have to deal with. Starts on suspense, starts on doing something. And that also skips the part where you dangle a mission and one of the players decides to go, well, are we really interested in going to the Knoll Castle? It's like, yes, you're interested in going to the Knoll Castle, Dwight. And so you start in the Knoll Castle to eliminate Dwight, stopping the action and giving you one of the bad kind of downbeats where you have to petition dramatically the player to accept the darn premise of the scenario.
I swear to God, when Steve switched to Night Shift, we thought we were getting away from this thing, but his buddy Dwight is just as bad, frankly.
His buddy Dwight. Yeah, I think Steve may have instructed Dwight to be like this.
Yep.
And so other examples of that, you don't have to start literally with a fight. You could have a group in a dark corridor and they hear footsteps, or there's an uncrewed defense drone coming your way toward your spacecraft and it's ready to fire. There you go. There's a problem. Or, you know, you're unpacking your ghost hunting gear in the haunted resort and, you hear an unearthly groan. So even if you then backtrack to explain what it is that you're doing, that question, that procedural beat is hanging in the air, waiting to be picked up. And you have to make sure you get to it soon enough that the players don't forget that they're in this situation, but it's there ready to do its job for you. The other thing about an in media res opening is that the procedural beat is followed by a question beat. It's like, oh, we're being attacked by gnolls. It's like, where are we? Why are we being attacked by gnolls? And that's where you fill in the just enough of the backstory to get them through the gnoll fight. And then you can, once that is dealt with, you can then explain in more detail while they're there and while they're why they're doing that. And so that immediately gets the up and down beats going right away and avoids that string of lateral beats that happens if you give Dwight too much of a chance to gum up the works.
And then if you're not in the opening beat of the adventure or the opening beat of the campaign, how exciting, but you stopped last week and you were in the middle of something, whatever you were in the middle of, you started up with a previously, maybe, to get everyone back on team. And the way that ideally you would do a previously is to have the previously itself, like a mission setup, propose another question or let the players fix themselves into the world in a, were we that far? Did we get into the top floor of the castle already? Oh, goodness. And then that previously moment, the moment where you're starting doing the thing that you were doing last week at the end of play, hopefully is already in a procedural beat or is already amenable to being a series of questions and answers, rapid fire, of course, from the players and the GM. Is that fair to say?
Yes. And so in that one, the players, you can just ask the players to ask the questions, right? What were you doing? What do you do now? And the process of players recapping each other on what happened, with the GM filling in little bits that they're eliding, especially if they're recapping for a player who was absent last week, that has its own sort of riffy, fun dynamic and is a fun sort of shift to ramp up slowly, because you don't want to just be hitting people with a whole steady series of problems or make them feel overwhelmed. You also need to release the tension every so often. And usually the players will help that by throwing in jokes. But if not, you can kind of make sure that also you're not causing the opposite problem of too many downbeats in a row, too much information to take in. And that can be just as problematic, if not worse, than a boring series of lateral beats. And so you can sort of pay attention to what's being said. There'll often be jokes and fun in that bit. And then that enables you to kind of pull out of the relaxed socializing part of the evening and into the game itself, and is a nice transition. Of course, that's a thing that only applies in, you know, regular in-person play, whereas in a con scenario, you want to get things jumping right away. If it's pure sandbox play, again, that has a series of up and down beats, and you can, for example, provide information. You can say, okay, well, you're arriving in the Skeleton City, and then you describe the Skeleton City in a suggestive way that indicates what it is that they're going to go and possibly do. One of the players may pop in with a question. You then can provide them the exposition you have in your notes, but instead of having jumped the gun and gone straight to the exposition, you're waiting for a player to signal that and ask what's going on. You can provide them with an answer, and it's much more satisfying when it's in response to a query. And then another player might have another question based on what you said, and then you can build out from there, maybe describe the social situation. And so subtly, you're doing the thing that you would do in any sandbox situation where they've moved to an area, which is lay out a bunch of possible plot hooks that for them to explore, but you're doing it in a Q&A format that is therefore more engaging and has all of those ups and downs. And so that gets us then finally from our session zero, then our mission introduction, next week we will get to the part where they actually start doing stuff. They fight the gnolls, they investigate the unearthly sound, and we'll be back to get into that. But I am now going to pose the question of what exciting hut and or segment waits on the other side of this commercial.
In a hole in the ground, they found a body.
I know! Here we are in Maryshire, right in the middle of the beautiful bucolic riding.
So bucolic.
With its neat hedgerows, and picturesque taverns, and delightful crumpet shops, and quaint little village greens.
Can we go back to the crumpets?
Yes, yeah, so what did you want to know about them?
I wanted to have some crumpets and shut off the recording.
Okay, let's do that.
Okay, we're back. What were we saying?
Murder!
Murder?
Yes, we've got murder to solve.
In the bucolic riding? Where all the halflings live?
Yes, the halflings. Plus also some boggarts, pukas, and dwarves. But weren't we concerned about something?
Murder?
Yes, murder! Another case in need of sleuthing by a team of amateur detectives.
It would be unthinkable if this wasn't the third murder this week.
Maryshire Detective Club is a fantasy mystery-solving RPG.
By the master of fantasy and mystery.
And fantasy mystery.
Gareth Ryder Hanrahan.
Investigate crimes, question eccentric neighbors, stop for tea and cakes, unravel puzzles, and get involved in pedantic arguments about jam.
Wait, what kind of jam?
In the most adorable,
but still murdery,
gumshoe game yet, you gather clues, uncover motives, follow gossip, question suspicious neighbors, stop for lunch, get sidetracked, remember you're supposed to be solving a case, gather some more clues, question more eccentric locals,
possibly chase a swan or something,
and slowly piece together the truth.
Now on BackerKit from Pelgrane Press.
Type BackerKit and Maryshire into your favorite search engine to find the campaign page. The banging of pickaxes, the wearing of pith helmets, and sometimes the scrubbing of precious ancient statues with steel wool inform us that we're in the archaeology hut, but this is a proper old-timey archaeology hut, because I thought we would look into the question of the Elgin marbles. Specifically, how did Elgin get the Greek marbles that are famously in the British Museum? We sort of shorthand that as often as we go, oh, yep, that's colonialism for you. But it turns out that it's a slightly circuitous form of colonialism. It's part of the story, but it's through several removes, because spoiler, Britain did not control Greece when Lord Elgin packed up those marbles and took them away. Also, when he got them back to Britain, there was a lot of, do we want these?
Yeah.
Was that legal?
Did we have an order for marbles? Anyone order marbles?
Yeah.
Possibly while stoned? I'm looking at you, Lord North.
Yeah, so it's a much different story with more curlicues than you might think, and we're here to lay it on you. And I guess this story starts all the way back in 447 BC, when a sculptor looks at a bunch of blocks of marble and goes, hey, those should be like centaurs and gods and stuff, and takes his chisel and gets started getting this story in motion.
Yeah, that sculptor is traditionally identified as Phidias, and why would we not? So Phidias designs and oversees the adornment of the Parthenon, which is the giant civic temple to Athena at the top of the Acropolis, the fortified hill in Athens. And this is Athens' golden age. And they say, oh, right, we're in a golden age. We should build possibly the most beautiful building ever to exist. So get on that. And they built the Parthenon, a model of perfect proportion and grace. And then they said, I don't know, it looks kind of, what I want to say, unsculptured. So Phidias get to that. So yes,
it looks a little Spartan, and we hate that.
Exactly. That would be anti-Athenian. So we got something cool. Let's make it complicated and cool. And so Phidias does sculptural elements for the four sides of the temple for all the vertical surfaces. So the temple has an outside frieze, which is topped by a line of what are called metopes, which are sculptural elements that go on top of the outside frieze below the pediment, which is the big triangle part you're thinking of if you're thinking of the Parthenon. So the pediment, then you've got the metopes below the pediment and on the sides between the pediments. And then inside that ring of columns, there is the inside face of the Parthenon, what's called the cella, and that has its own frieze on it. And so the metopes are on the east, the Gigantomachy, the War of the Gods and Giants. On the west, the Amazonomachy, the war between Athens and the hated Amazons. On the south, the Centauromachy, the war between the centaurs and the Lapiths, just because I think they were in a Machy mode by that point. And on the north side is the Sack of Troy, which Athens had famously nothing to do with except to add 10 of its ships in the edited version of the Iliad, but still, it's something the Greeks did.
Well, that was a Chris Nolan tie-in.
Exactly, right. It was, you get a popcorn bucket if you're there at the Parthenon dedication. So the frieze on the cella on the inside is probably a Pan-Athenaic procession, and I guess it's spoilers to say not enough of it remains to know what it was. And then on the pediments, on the east side is the birth of Athena, and on the west side is the war between Athena and Poseidon over who will own Athens. And so everyone loves the Parthenon. They love Phidias. He's carried about the city on people's shoulders, I assume. It lasts for about 800 years, 900 years. In 484 AD, someone looks around and says, aren't we Christians? Should we have a temple to Athena? Maybe not. And so they close the Parthenon down and turn it into a church of the Virgin Mary. And then a little bit later, someone says, just asking again, aren't we Christians? And should we have a bunch of statues of gods on our temple to the Virgin Mary? And everyone says, all right, maybe not statues of gods. So they deface all the gods. They leave the heroes and the centaurs and stuff. But now we don't have any gods. Is everyone happy?
At least it was targeted vandalism.
It sort of buckets along until 1480, when it becomes a mosque. And the Turks, who have conquered Greece, turn it into a mosque. And then they seemingly sort of lose interest. What they actually lose is executive function for running Greece, because by the time of the war in the 17th century between the Ottomans and Venice, it is not a mosque because the Turks fill it with gunpowder. They turn it into the arsenal to defend the Acropolis against the Venetian besiegers. And I don't think you do that to a mosque, generally. And there is some possibility that the Ottomans were like, well, the Venetians would never vandalize a precious architectural monument, apparently having never looked up Venetians in any book. So in 1687, the General Morosini says, shoot at the ammo magazine. A Venetian mortar shell comes down on the Parthenon, detonates the gunpowder, and a whole bunch of the inner walls are blown to heck. And that's why we don't know what the frieze on the cella mostly was. Morosini takes the Parthenon from the Ottomans, and then he says, these are cool statues. They'd look good in Venice, but they're too big. And when he tries to pry them off the sides of the Parthenon, they fall down and smash. And all the other statues got blown up by someone. He doesn't know who, maybe him. So he just smashes up the big statues and leaves, and that's it. So now we have the Parthenon, former mosque, surrounded by rubble. And so the people living in Athens say, well, this is all good quality marble. We'll use it to build walls and houses and stuff. We'll use it for infill. So they start carrying bits of the Parthenon down to put in their houses. And that's the situation when in 1798, a Scotsman named Thomas Bruce, who is the 7th Earl of Elgin, becomes British ambassador to Turkey. Turkey is neutral in the war between Britain and Napoleon. Elgin's job is to keep them that way. And so he is also an antiquarian by avocation. And he says, well, if I'm going to Turkey anyway, why don't we just do a full casting and sketches copy of the Parthenon, which a different batch of Italians had said, oh, right, it's the Parthenon, the most beautiful building in history. Maybe don't blow it up. But they didn't write that down really hard. The British government says, did you know there's a war on, Lord Elgin? Did you know it's not at all your job to do archaeology? You're supposed to be in Constantinople persuading the Sultan to stay on side. So no, you can't do that. But you can't tell a Scots lord what to do. So he pays for the casting and sketches copy himself. And so he puts an architect named Luzieri in charge of the site. So Luzieri is there in Athens. Elgin is in Constantinople, probably coming back and forth every time. And by 1801, his architect is removing statues from the site, maybe to cast them better, maybe for some other reason. And then also, not just the Parthenon, but statues and columnar capitals from a different temple, the Erechtheion, which is the monument to the birth of Erechtheus, the Propylaea, which is another temple, and the temple of Athena Nike, which are all on the Acropolis. So they're gathering up a bunch of statues and architectural ornament. And as they're doing this, Elgin begins to think, this might begin to cross a line. So he goes back to the Sultan and he says that he gets a firman, which is a decree from the Sultan to let him keep any sculptures he finds around the Parthenon. And it just as a public service. And later scholars say that was not a firman. That was just a note from the acting vizier. There's nothing about it in the archives of the Sultan that we have. And defenders of Elgin say, well, those archives are badly maintained. There's stuff missing from them. And there's a copy of the firman in Athens, but the Greeks burned it down when they were getting their independence. So what can you do? But we do have an Italian copy of the firman if you'd like to look at it. And I think everyone says, I don't think that's a chain of provenance so much. But against that, the Turkish governor of Athens is clearly allowing an Italian to pry sculptures off the walls of the Parthenon. So that must have been approved at some level, at least the level of the governor of Athens. And in 1802, I guess he writes a note back to the Sultan to say, was I right to do this? And the Sultan sends him a note back that says, yes, you're absolutely right. Keep on governing Athens. Stop bothering me with nonsense. Don't you know there's a war on?
Right. And there's a lot of back and forth over the generations over the exact nature of the agreement or whether there was an agreement. And so it's all very up in the air, depending on where you think the marbles should be.
Right. Well, we know that there definitely must have been something because the Ottomans generally did not let people just cart sculptures away from their cities without some kind of note. And so,
yes, it's hard to imagine that there would even be, you know, it would even be an issue of tacit approval. You're just not going to do that.
Right. Yeah.
Doesn't make any sense.
So in 1803, Elgin's ambassadorial position ends with the Peace of Amiens. So there's no more war. So no more need to keep the Sultan suite. So Elgin leaves Luzieri on the spot to keep on demarbling. He's onto a good thing now. And he ships the marbles that they've taken off to Malta for storage. Part of the first shipment of marbles sinks off Cape Matapan, south of Greece. And rather than say, oh, well, marble's going to sink, Elgin does the mensch thing and he pays to have it raised from the bottom of the sea. Do not ask questions about would it be at the bottom of the sea if he kept his grubby hands to himself. And that whole first shipment of marbles gets to England in 1807. In 1810, he gets an export visa from the Turkish government to ship the rest of the marbles to Britain, which is reaffirmed in 1811. And then he does, in fact, ship the rest of his goodies off to Britain.
Seems like pretty solid paperwork.
Yep. Can't beat that for 1801. This is rock solid. So of the Parthenon sculptures that did exist in 1801 that had survived 1,000 years of erosion or 2,000 years of erosion, that had survived the Christians defacing the gods, that had survived the Turks turning it into an arsenal, that had survived the Venetians blowing it up, half of the stuff that had survived that made it to England. And that is 21 statues from the east and west pediments, 15 of the original 92 metopes from the south side. So it's mostly the Centaurum Archi, and 75 meters of the original 160 meters of the frieze, the cella frieze, the inside frieze. So at the end of the day, Elgin has spent 74,240 pounds of his own money, which is about 6 million pounds today, although purchasing power is obviously so much higher now that it ought to be maybe another digit on that. So he's sketched, demarbled, and shipped the Parthenon sculptures, and he sold them to the British Museum in 1816 for 35,000 pounds. So he takes a bath on the whole deal. But there is, as we alluded at the beginning of this, great debate in Parliament as to, do we want to do this? How are you doing this? And Elgin was sort of pushing the issue by opening his own museum right next to the British Museum that had the Elgin marbles in it and saying, come see my marbles. The British government doesn't want these to be the patrimony of the British people. I'm sure I have nothing to do with that. I'm just a simple marble thiever. Among the people at the time who objected very strenuously to this whole operation was Lord Byron, who was Philhellenic par excellence, and he may have written a graffito that showed up on the now blank walls of the Parthenon in Latin that said quod non fecerunt goti, hoc fecerunt scoti, which is to say what the Goths did not do, the Scots did. And then he was still mad. So for the debate, he writes a poem called The Curse of Minerva, which is Athena, alias Minerva in Latin, cursing Lord Elgin and Britain itself. So this is Athena talking. She says, "What more I owe, let gratitude attest, no Alaric, the Visigoth, and Elgin did the rest, that all may learn from whence the plunderer came, the insulted wall sustains his hated name," because Lord Elgin carved his name into the walls of the Parthenon. "For Elgin's fame thus grateful palace pleads, below his name, above, behold his deeds, be ever hailed with equal honor here, the Gothic monarch and the Pictish peer. Arms gave the first his right, the last had none, but basely stole what lesser barbarians won." And that is what happens when Byron is mad at you. But also what happens when Byron is mad at you is the British government keeps the marbles. So there we are.
Right. But he wasn't alone in that. And there was considerable controversy whether this was worth spending any money on. Because, you know, as we said previously, one of the points was we didn't ask you to spend all this money, Lord Elgin. And also there were questions at the time. Was this legal? Did you get the correct permission? Is the paperwork right? So the ethics of housing all of these things in England were discussed very much at the time, although, of course, having them as opposed to shipping them back won the argument.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that Elgin would keep them regardless is, I guess, sort of the winning argument there. It should be in the British Museum, where they can be planed flat by idiots in the 1930s, not to, you know, ding the British Museum, but they did sand the patina off of it.
Yeah, so there were scandals in the 30s where they were scrubbed with steel wool and badly damaged in the name of primitive restoration. And so there are lots of other things in the British Museum that have a very clear cut, we stole this and put it in our museum sequence of events. But this sequence of events is perhaps a little bit more equivocal than people have in mind when they're thinking that. So of course, there's centaurs, there's obviously the gods got all their faces smashed off, but they might be kind of mad about that. And some of their anger might linger around the British Museum. And there's also the possibility that maybe the statue that Poseidon really wanted to sink when he caused that ship to go under is still in the depths, and perhaps your modern day adventurers need to go and retrieve it for some Poseidon angering reason.
Or they hear a rumor that Elgin did not rescue all the statues from the wreck of the Mentor, which went down off Mattapan, and that a shadowy billionaire is offering them big money to go get those statues for his private art museum. And he doesn't even have to be Scots in this version. He could be anything. So you're diving down there, and it turns out that the reason Elgin's men left it is because, as you say, it is possessively owned by Poseidon. And maybe it's a statue of Amphitrite, his lovely wife. And he doesn't want other people gawping at it. And so you go down there, and by now Poseidon's servants, who may or may not be fish, frog, batrachian humanoids, or they might be just very mean dolphins, are there to mess you up. And it becomes the beginning of an adventure. And now you have a billionaire who you suspect has other occult artifacts in his private art museum. And you have to figure out where he got them and maybe do a little bit of restitution yourself, or maybe just steal them and sell them to a different billionaire and keep more of the cut. I'm not your boss.
Well, on that note, it's time for us to close up this hut and see what other hut and or segment waits on the other side of this scintillating commercial.
Play The King in Yellow has haunted imaginations like a dirge since its first appearance in 1895.
But among the fortune tellers of Europe, the play was not the fearful beginning of something new, but the culmination of something older, The King in Yellow Tarot.
Daniel Harms and John Scott Tynes, famous clairvoyants, divined the form's importance of this Carcosan deck.
Painter Kurt Komoda, in a fevered fugue of inspiration, reproduced designs thought long lost.
Spread the cards.
Let the king in yellow tell your fate.
There is no other who could.
After all, you have seen the yellow sign.
The King in Yellow Tarot is a complete deck of 78 cards in full color.
Sturdy cards with a soothing, silky finish.
Inspired by the works of Robert W. Chambers.
An accompanying 28-page guide explores the history of the deck and recommends, hesitantly, its technique.
A complete PDF of cards and guide comes with your order.
Add to cart at shop.arcdream.com.
That's your reality shattered cart at shop.arcdream.com.
Spare this podcast a bittersweet life experience by joining such beloved Patreon backers as
Josh Street,
Nate Merritt,
Urs Blumentritt,
Chad Ward,
and Chris McCarthy.
Once more, we enter that hut that seems to be a little bit backstage, a little bit off the side of the narrative hut. It's doesn't have our rising triangle in it. There's no room. It's barely enough room for the comedy mask and the mask of Punchinello and all the costumes and props. Because here in this hut, as we dig through it, we discover the beanie of the stock character, the Kid. And the Kid is not just any child character. It is a specific character arc as part of a story. And Robin, tell us, what is the Kid and what is just a young member of the cast?
Right. So the Kid undergoes an arc from innocence to experience, the classic arc of the coming of age tale, which we will mention various examples of. And so, as you say, not just any child, but the Kid. And I'm sort of borrowing a term kind of from the Western, where there are lots of the kids. But this goes back into the furthest reaches of the literary tradition. Often, when the Kid is not the protagonist, they are the foil to another character, the old hand, the character who knows what's going on. Or conversely, the old hand is a secondary character and a foil to the Kid protagonist. This, like many other stock characters, it has adjacency to other similar ones. So, for example, an adult may be the greenhorn. So it's someone who's not a child at all, but still winds up in an unfamiliar environment where they don't know the rules and have to figure them out. So that might not literally be innocence to experience. It might be arrogance to wisdom, but it's a pretty similar character type. And Ken, you found a super early example to start us off with.
Yeah. As always, when you're looking for the beginnings of Western narrative, you go to the Bible because it is the oldest Western narrative that we have been building on for 3,000 years. And the first Kid is a guy named David, and he's just a simple shepherd. He just sings. He's got his sling and he steps up to do an adventure, and that sends him on his character arc. You kill one giant and then everyone expects you to be a resistance hero and a Robin Hood and then the king. And so he goes from sling to king. And by the time he's the king, he has definitely reached experience. He is now shadily machinating against other innocent guys just because he covets their wife, that kind of thing. Not cool, King David. And sacking Jerusalem from the Hivites, who don't deserve it because it's too cool. And so that's the story of David. He's the first ever the Kid in narrative that I found anyway. And after David, you can look at other possible examples, but the one that I like is Percival. He's the classic zero to hero kid in the Arthurian mythos. He shows up as literally the model of a giant bumpkin. He doesn't even know what a spear is because his mom has raised him in such a backwater, but he just knows knighthood exists and he's drawn to it and he wants to be a knight. And the other knights sort of make fun of him and let him goof around. But sure enough, he's the one who sees the grail first and gets that whole thing started off. And so he is either over the course of his apprenticeship and knighthood or over the course of the grail quest, depending on which Percival story you're reading, he does that kid arc. He goes from, golly gee, mister, it's a grail, to, oh, the grail. And then that's the Percival story. And it's the classic kid story.
Right. The next classic example makes us question what exactly we mean by innocence, because that's Prince Hal from Shakespeare's history plays. And classically, he goes from being immature to becoming more cynical. And that is the turning point there, is his turning his back on Falstaff. So that is, he's a hellraiser. He's a roisterer. He's a carouser, but he is unformed as a, he's still, you know, a surly teen who doesn't know what's what, who then has to become a king. And so innocence is maybe literal, you know, being pure at heart and kindly and so forth, or it may be in the more classical sense of unawareness, being innocent of what's really going on. And often the arc there is to the experience in particular is not necessarily a great thing. It's often toward cynicism. Jane Austen has a number of kids who have to learn lessons about life, Emma and Marianne Dashwood in particular. Dickens, of course, has lots of young protagonists and lots of travails for them to go through. So, of course, lots of versions of this archetype. Oliver Twist, who has the Artful Dodger as an old hand, Nicholas Nickleby, and from Bleak House, Esther Summerson also fits in there. Headed over to American literature, Tom Sawyer, of course, is the classic kid. Huck Finn is not the kid in Tom Sawyer. He's either the old hand or a trickster or kind of both. And in his own novel, he has a quite different arc. He goes from monster to maybe redeemed.
Yeah, he's never innocent, is our Huck Finn. No, that's the whole point of him.
Exactly. And going to throw in a canlit title, Mordecai Rickler's The Apprenticeship of Duty Kravitz. That's right there in the title. And again, it's not a sober wisdom he achieves, a cynicism that propels him through life and cameo appearances in later Rickler novels.
Right. And this was such an arc that the Germans developed a word for it, the Bildungsroman, the romance of learning what the world looks like, basically. And so every Goethe poem has got a kid in it, and the kid either grows up or kills himself. It's if it's The Sorrows of Young Werther. So over and over and over, romantic and Victorian literature is full of the kids. And we could just sit here all day and talk about Treasure Island, but then we'd be talking about that. And as always, you take something that's great in literature and then you dumb it down for the funny papers, and you get a kid that doesn't have an arc and just sort of like bats around, and it can still be great, but it's not the kid. And that is Robin, for example. He's never innocent. He begins the victim of a horrible crime like Bruce Wayne did, and he instantly becomes a young crime fighter. There is no montage sequence even in the original comics. He's just, oh, he's an acrobat. Obviously, he can fight bank robbers. That makes sense. Look how Olga Corbett used to do that all the time in the 70s. So although they are, you know, often called a kid sidekick, they are not a the kid. And I guess that's the point we're making, right?
Right. And that's a young iconic hero, a child who's already an iconic hero. So other examples, Prince Valiant. I think he sometimes has some life lessons, but he's already pretty badass.
Yeah.
Bucky, Captain America's Bucky, of course. And although arguably later in the later lore, he evolves into an even worse form of himself. And therefore, you could argue that in the way of de-iconicizing heroes to give them a different understanding and arc, maybe the Winter Soldier possibly is an example of that. You mentioned in our notes here, is Short Round from the Temple of Doom, is he a kid or a small badass? And I'm going to say he's a small badass because I don't think he has much of an arc, right? And you also have an exception to point out in terms of your innocence to experience arc has to be a significant chunk of the narrative for us to want to call you the kid, right?
If it just happens in your training montage, then you're not the kid. That was just how you became either an iconic hero or became the whatever the adventure type is that you're going to go on. Ana de Armas in Ballerina is not the kid because her innocence to experience happens in like the first 20 minutes of the movie when she goes and gets trained to be an assassin at one of the many happy assassin training clubs in the John Wick universe.
Right. On the other hand, Luke Skywalker gets to undergo that arc for three movies and then in the later sequels becomes the old hand who trains someone else out of being the kid. So he gets to go full circle on that. Star Trek shows often have a kid slot, less obviously with Chekhov, although that was the impulse there was get a younger actor in there. And then Gene Roddenberry made it weird by making him Russian and disguising the fact that he was the kid character. But the next swing at that was very obvious. It was Wesley Crusher, Jake Sisko in Deep Space Nine. And along the way, there have been various other versions of the kid disguised in various ways until we get to Starfleet Academy, where almost the entire cast is the kid. There's a whole bunch of the kids to undergo that arc. In Hitchcock's Shadow of a Doubt, Charlie Newton, played by Teresa Wright, is very much the kid. She undergoes that discovery of life when she realizes that the uncle she adores is played by Joseph Cotten is very possibly a serial killer. Mm-hmm. And there is a younger sister character, but she's not the kid per se. She's more of the wisecracking observer type. So your age alone does not dictate whether you're the kid. For example, you can be a young grown-up who knows how to shoot people, like Chico, played by Horst Buchholz in The Magnificent Seven. But he's the version of the greenhorn who needs to learn from all of the more grizzled older members of the group. And very much reprising that is Matt Damon as Linus in the Ocean's 11 movies, which even though there seem to be younger members of the crew, he's the one who's the kid.
Right.
The other ones are the rustics, the mechanicals, the knuckleheads. But he's the one who undergoes the tutelage and at the end of the original three films winds up ready to go off on his own and be, you know, fully experienced in the ways of con artistry.
And before we leave the West entirely, the classic kid to old hand duo is True Grit. And so Maddie, played by Kim Darby in 1969 and Haley Steinfeld in 2010, are the kid. You can again say they had a horrific offstage thing that sort of awakens them to the realities of the world, parents being killed. But over the course of True Grit, they really learn what it is to seek revenge and what that means and what that story is. So it is very much an experience arc at the hands of the old hand.
Right. And you can be extremely precocious and seemingly wise, but really learn the real deal through experience.
Right.
And sometimes the kid is a little disguised. You have someone who seems like the kid isn't. So in another classic Western, Rio Bravo, also in the original film version with John Wayne, Colorado, played by Ricky Nelson, seems to be a kid. He's young. He's the junior partner, but he's extremely capable throughout. And his arc is a different classic arc from selfishness to altruism. Originally, he wants to keep his nose out of the trouble that John Wayne and Dean Martin and Walter Brennan are in. But finally, he is awakened to the need to join a community and to sacrifice it for it. The 70s film Thunderbolt and Lightfoot with Clint
Classic
Eastwood.
Classic Clint Eastwood.
Jeff Bridges as Lightfoot is an interesting twist on the kid. Jeff Bridges plays sort of a proto Lebowski who's something of a aw shucks knucklehead car thief. And there is a interesting outcome of that I won't spoil, that speaks to the relationship between the old hand, who's very much the protagonist, and the kid, who's very much a foil character. In the film Bad Santa, someone definitely learns a lot by hanging around with Billy Bob Thornton, and that character is just literally called the kid. The actor who plays him is Brett Kelly.
Your mention of Thunderbolt Lightfoot, of course, reminds me of the other classic, The Kid, which is Natalie Portman in Leon the Professional, in which that is the whole point of the movie, is the arc. And although you might think, oh no, it's about Leon softening and becoming human, spoilers, it is not about that. It is about Natalie Portman realizing how god-awful the world can be and what she can do about it. And then, as we began with Robin, we can go out on Spider-Man in the Marvel Universe. So from Civil War to Homecoming, he very much is arguably presented as the kid, that the Civil War is sort of his opening bout of experience, and then Homecoming sort of finishes it off with, oh yeah, all of life is going to be Peter Parker's life, because that's how life is in the Marvel Universe. And that arc is another very classic one. And the fun thing is it happens over two movies as opposed to happening all in one movie. And that makes it kind of
right.
An interesting structural kid.
With Tony Stark as the old hand.
Right.
And then he needs a replacement old hand after that. So this is an interesting example of a stock character in that it crosses over between dramatic fiction, between literary fiction about character development, and is also very much part of the action-adventure genre, and so the primarily problem-solving narrative. And so I don't think we've come up with one until now that so clearly straddles those two things. Most of the YA canon is built on this arc. You know, Harry Potter absolutely follows that very explicitly, and I think that's a big part of its enduring popularity. More dramatic or literary-style characters in film include the two titular kids in Fanny and Alexander. My Life as a Dog and Lady Bird are both prime coming-of-age stories. We've discussed my impatience with that arc in that format previously on the show. And Stand By Me, I guess, is the ultimate coming-of-age story, because there's four contrasting kids who all undergo different versions of that arc from innocence to experience, because you don't get much more experience than a dead body and being menaced by Kiefer Sutherland.
Nope. That's experience right there in a box.
So in Page Turners, my game of a dramatic interaction for one player and one GM, Sarah Sam Saltiel's scenario Abyss and Shadow features a kid character who undergoes very probably a journey from innocence to experience. She's literally a child at the beginning of that. There may be a time jump depending on what you and your GM choose to do. And the old hand may be a supernatural being, a sort of shadowy figure in her life that is not a human as she copes with the difficulties of growing up with extreme tension within her family. So, and as we know from Page Turners, you and the GM have a lot of control over where that goes. So exactly where that ends up is up to you. You don't have to give her the innocence to experience arc, but that's the one that makes the most obvious sense, and I think will play as the most classic possible version of that story.
Well, once we have welcomed you from the Bible through the Western comics, literature, classic film, somewhat less classic film, and then into a plug for Page Turners, that is our arc from innocence to experience, and that means that must be the end of this segment. So experience teaches us to wait for the next segment and or HUD. The British are coming.
The Kickstarter campaign is almost upon us for Flagbearer Games' exciting Revolutionary War role-playing game, Nations and Cannons.
Thoroughly researched and beautifully illustrated, in Nations and Cannons you play as spies, skirmishers, and saboteurs in the battle for the future of the 13 colonies.
The next book, The American Crisis, Dark and Bloody Ground, follows the actions of the war in the South and the West with historical adventures, setting information, perfidious new enemies, and a sprawling campaign.
The Kickstarter campaign also features a revised core book supporting play in other eras, a supplement about political scheming within the two sides of the war, and years of maps, supplements, splat books, and adventures following the war from Boston to Yorktown.
Nations and Cannons is 5e compatible and focuses on unconventional heroes from underrepresented perspectives.
This Kickstarter is the best time ever to get into Nations and Cannons.
Sign up to be notified of the Kickstarter campaign at yourdadwilllovethis.com. It's time once more to wend our way up the creakety cobweb stairs. We're going to stop on the landing and wave to the Portrait of the Fire Salamander. He's going to wave on back because he's magical. And he's super interested in this one because fire salamanders really feel that the Renaissance was one of their best times. So we're going to head on in to the parlor of the consulting occultist, where our informant waits for us in his smoking jacket to tell us about someone we mentioned recently, realized we hadn't covered in detail. And that's Athanasius Kircher, who is, or probably Kircher? Do we know the pronunciation of that?
Kircher, I assume. But I think we're probably going to start pronouncing it Kircher before this segment is over.
Right. And he is a classic example of a Renaissance polymath who looks into and writes some occult-style texts. In addition to a whole lot of science, he makes some automatons. He's got a big bibliography. And he has prophetic visions. He's absolutely up our alley here in consulting occultists. So Ken, take us to 1602, the year of his birth.
Yep. As you mentioned, he is a Renaissance man. He is arguably the last Renaissance man in that he is the last major figure to look at the world the way the Renaissance did, as part of a constructed whole, a divine diagram that God had made and revealed to everyone through the arts of philosophy and reason. And this sort of rediscovery of this Aquinian structure is what kickstarts the Renaissance, really, with all the Greek texts coming to Italy. And then Kircher is almost the last guy who does all this without boring things like experimenting. And so he is the pinnacle, if you will, of Hermetic science. And he is, as you say, born in 1602 in the little town of Geisa, which is near Fulda. If anyone is familiar with the geography of Thuringia in Germany, he is one of nine children of the town's bailiff, then mayor. He has a gift for languages as a boy. He learns Hebrew from the town rabbi while attending Jesuit school. And in 1618, the Jesuit school has done its job. He becomes a Jesuit novice. The 30 Years' War also breaks out that year, so he has to flee the Protestant armies northwest to Koblenz, where he becomes a school teacher. He teaches in Koblenz and Cologne and Mainz, back and forth. He teaches mathematics, Hebrew, and Syriac, which is what they called Aramaic back then. In 1625, the Archbishop Elector of Mainz is, you know, touring the school, and they get Kircher to show off a big display for him. It's fireworks, it's moving scenery, it's all kind of mechanical arts, and everyone at the school says, "We did not know that was coming, Archbishop Elector. Our apologies for black magic in your presence. We'll have that guy punished." And Kircher says, "No, no, I did it by natural philosophy." And he shows them how all of those, the scenery worked. And the Archbishop Elector of Mainz says, you come to Mainz. You teach people in Mainz. This is much more important. And you hang out with me." So in 1628, he becomes ordained to the priesthood, becomes a full on Jesuit. And his buddy, the Archbishop, gets him an appointment as the professor of ethics and mathematics at Würzburg. And I guess the ethics is showing how the trick was done. That's what helped out there.
Yeah, so it's a classic magician's thing of, how did you do that trick?
Yep.
Magician never reveals his secrets. Is it black magic? Let me show you.
Let me reveal my secrets.
Yeah.
So in 1630, the Jesuits are sending missionaries to China. He petitions to join that mission. They reject him. I assume the Archbishop of Mainz wants him to stick around in Würzburg, but God has other plans. In 1631, he has a prophetic vision of armed cavalry and a bright light over Würzburg. He tells everyone on the faculty and that they start packing up because there's a sign that something's going to happen. And sure enough, something does happen. The city is captured by Protestants, but warned by his vision, he has escaped to Avignon in France, and a new noble mentor, a guy named Peiresc, who is a mathematical scholar. And he studies Coptic because Peiresc has a big library of Coptic, Ethiopian, and Egyptian manuscripts. And while he's in Avignon, he identifies Coptic as the successor language to ancient Egyptian. This is him being right. This will not happen all the time. He also publishes his first ever book, Ars Magnesia, which is all about magnets. It's everything we know about magnets, which is to say it's mostly lifted from Gilbert and the other English magnet guys, but he's putting it in Latin and Catholic terms, so it counts. And even in Ars Magnesia, he's saying magnets are similar to God's love for us because they draw things to them just as God's love draws us to God. And this is the sort of the way that his mind works, is that everything in the world is an example or a correspondence or a mirror image of everything else in the world, because that's how God would build things, so that you could reason it out.
And that's what makes him a Renaissance guy and not an Enlightenment guy.
Right. So in 1633, he gets appointed a royal mathematician at the Habsburg court in Vienna. This is Kepler's old job. Peiresc immediately starts pulling strings to not have him buried in the imperial capital. And so he's on his way to Vienna. He gets diverted by a storm in Rome. And Peiresc has by then convinced the Pope to appoint him professor of mathematics at the Jesuit College of Rome. And so Pope outranks emperor, or at least it does in Rome. So certainly for the Jesuits, it does. And so Kircher stays there.
And a storm suggests some entity is putting a finger on the scale. So
exactly.
The
God also has a vote. So in 1636, he publishes the first ever Coptic grammar with an appendix on hieroglyphics. They sort of, I'm going to get to that, but here's a Coptic grammar. And Frederick of Hesse-Darmstadt, who was a Protestant and converted to Catholicism, comes to Italy to pilgrimage to Rome. They think it would be a great idea for Kircher to be his confessor. And so he gets sent to follow Frederick. Frederick goes down into the rest of Italy. So with Frederick, he travels to Sicily, where he tries to replicate Archimedes' ship-killing mirror, and also where he reads the Book of Enoch. Very cool. Right.
And ship-killing mirror, let's remember that when we get to the MacGuffins at the end.
Right, yep. And so he goes to Malta, where he maybe reads the Book of Mad Desire for the Knowledge of Written Symbols from episode 703, which is when we said, have we not done Athanasius Kircher? Really? And he also invents a machine for telling time everywhere in the world and for diagnosing diseases. And it's a calendar and an orrery, so you can do astronomical tracking. And it has fun facts about the continents carved on it. So it's a perfect device.
It's a smartphone.
It's so good. In 1638, he realizes that hanging around in Malta is not going to get him anywhere, so he pulls some strings and gets transferred back to Rome. But on the way, he sees two volcanoes. He sees Etna and Stromboli, and he's in Naples, and he sees that Vesuvius is getting ready to erupt, and he says, "Lower me into the crater of Vesuvius. I want to see what it looks like." And apparently the Neapolitans are used to this kind of thing, so they do it. He comes back out of the crater, which I guess a lot of people didn't. Pliny the Elder, looking at you. 1641, he's back in Rome, and he writes his big book on magnets, not magnesia, but magnes. And it describes
his magnet opus, if you will.
Everyone loves that joke. In the book on magnets, he also describes a magnetic clock that he has invented and a magnetic perpetual motion machine, which he sort of does more as a thought experiment. In 1646 is his big book of optics, and that's eclipses, telescopes, astronomy, color theory, an improved magic lantern for projecting images on the wall. You know, optics. He's into optics, so in 1646, he also uses his microscope, which he has, to detect plague bacilli. And you get a lot of people, Robin, who say his primitive microscope could not have seen a tiny little plague bacillus. He must have just seen red blood cells. And I say, I don't know about you, but I feel like Athanasius Kircher is going to know a bacillus from a blood cell. And so he may not have seen a plague bacillus. He might have seen some other kind of a thing, but he saw something. And he says that this is the little horrible animal, the animalcule that causes the plague. In 1658, he writes a big book on how to cure the plague when there's a plague in Rome. And what you do about plague, obviously, Robin, and this is what we do now. You burn infected clothing and infected houses. You have a quarantine, keep people away from the plague. You wear your face mask and you wear a dead toad around your neck. So it's a straight line to modern medical science.
Yeah, the dead toad is for social distancing. People don't want to come near your stinky old dead toad.
Exactly. And also it naturally attracts the poison out of the plague and into the dead toad. So you're safe. Also that year, he is relieved of his teaching load and just assigned to write more books. He basically becomes a research fellow at the College of Rome.
The dream of every academic.
Exactly. So now things really ramp up. In 1650, the Pope has found an obelisk and wants it put up in the Piazza Navona. And he says, "Hey, Kircher, you know hieroglyphs. Why don't you translate the hieroglyphs on the side of the obelisk?" And Kircher says, "I'm going to tell you better than that. I'm going to predict the hieroglyphs that will be found when you find the rest of the obelisk." And they are the ones that he predicted. And everyone's very impressed. Again, modern haters say that it's repeated on all four sides. He just knew that. I think that that's mean. He does not translate them correctly. He makes up a bunch of nonsense. What they actually are is praise of the Emperor Domitian, which is maybe why the Pope should not be putting up that obelisk, but let's not get into that. So in 1650, hieroglyphs are in the air, and he publishes the first of his four volumes of incorrectly translated hieroglyphs, Oedipus Egyptiacus. And according to him, hieroglyphs are basically the occult symbols of power. He does take on board the insight from the Book of Mad Desire for the Knowledge of Written Symbols that sometimes they just represent sounds, but mostly they represent occult symbols of power. And Champollion will use the texts that Kircher gathered for Oedipus Egyptiacus and a 1643 previous book on hieroglyphs to correctly translate the hieroglyphics, because that's where he gets his corpus of manuscripts. So there we are. 1650 is also the big musicology book, which includes the harmony of the spheres, a transcription of bird songs into musical notation. How do ears work? A device for generating random church music if you're tired of your church music, and plans for a hydraulic organ. If you want an organ powered by water, this would be how you do it. At this point, a nobleman leaves the College of Rome, his Wunderkammer, his Chamber of Wonders, his collection of weird stuff, and Kircher opens it up to the students at the college and anyone rich in Rome as the Museum Kircherianum, and adds to it from his own collection of ridiculous nonsense. So it is the first museum in term of art that exists, and he made it. 1656, he publishes the Itinerarium Ecstaticum, which is an astronomical treatise written as a travel narrative, so the opposite of most science fiction. And the angel Cosmael brings the narrator Theodidactus to many different stars, each of which has their own system of planets. It is dedicated to the Queen Christina of Sweden, who he had helped persuade to abdicate the throne of Sweden and convert to Catholicism. And when he publishes it, everyone says, isn't that Copernicanism? And he says, no, 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 if you'll check, each of the stars orbits a main planet, just like the sun orbits the Earth. It's just that all the other planets orbit the star. Do the math. And nobody does the math. And so he has to publish a sequel, or rather have his buddy Matthias Stock publish a sequel in which Cosmael comes back to explain that it was not either Copernicanism and what is wrong with you. But anyway, that's, you know, it's like Dune Messiah. Nobody reads that one. 1661, a buddy of his from Malta, from the old Malta days, becomes Pope Alexander VII. And coincidentally, Kircher gets permission to publish his books in Protestant Amsterdam. And the money starts pouring in, because Amsterdam is a much better place to distribute wonderfully illustrated Latin books. You can also probably pay for the nice illustrations now. Wonderfully illustrated Latin books about stuff. And so Kircher's books become bestsellers, and he is an intellectual celebrity in Europe at this time. Although I did not find out anything that like Robert Boyle or Isaac Newton thought of him. I don't know if they thought he was just an old goof, or if they said, well, he's got a perspective. So in 1661, he also discovers an old church established by the Emperor Constantine on the site of the miraculous deer of St. Eustace. St. Eustace was out hunting. He saw a deer with the cross of Christ between its antlers, and he was immediately converted, because that's what you were back in those days. And so Kircher begins raising money to restore that church. 1663, he writes Polygraphia Nova, which is his work of cryptography. And since it's a work of cryptography, he only publishes like 15 copies, and it sends it only to nobles and monarchs and the Pope so that they can write letters to each other. And it starts with a universal translator. So it's a bunch of thesaurus entries, and you take whatever your word is in your language and you turn it into an alphanumeric code. And then someone with a copy of the book can translate it back out of the alphanumeric code. So very cool. And then in the final part of that book, it is the description of how to work his steganographic arc, which is a box containing 144 tally sticks, which are basically slide rules for doing visionaire code tables. And all of the potentates who got the steganographic arc opened it up. They took out four or five of the tallies, said, put it back in their box and shelved it. No one ever used the steganographic arc.
Yeah, looks complicated. I'm a king. I don't have
exactly.
time for this.
It's like they bought a new board game and it looked really cool. And then they're, I'm never going to have time for this. 1665, he is sent the Voynich manuscript from all the way back in episode 65 to decipher. I assume he comes up with a translation and decides not to publish it because he's never met a alphabet he couldn't think he deciphered. But he also publishes Arithmology, about numbers, numerology, and gematria and Kabbalah. So that's his big number book.
Right. And that's right on the button in terms of being occult in nature, because a lot of these
right.
things.
Yeah. I mean, it's full of numerology. And he repeatedly explains that God created geometry, so magic with numbers is good, but the Kabbalah is wrong because it doesn't involve Christ. And so he has to say that a lot in this book. In 1665, he publishes Mundus Subterraneus, his study of the world below and of volcanoes and of ocean currents and how mountains work and the hollow earth and fossils and Atlantis. So anything you want to know about the Mundus Subterraneus, it's in this wonderful masterpiece. In 1667, he publishes an Encyclopedia of China, which is mostly based on the Jesuit missionary reports. He's been collecting them for 37 years. He organizes them all. It includes descriptions of dragons, because China has dragons, and the fun fact that Confucius was either Moses or Hermes Trismegistus. So the Chinese didn't know it, but thank goodness the Jesuits were here. 1669, he does Ars Magna Sciendi, which is an attempt to explain how to organize things like Athanasius Kircher. It's epistemology, the organization of knowledge. It also includes combinatorics, so early logic circuits, and a symbolic logic language, because he is by now making up new languages, which are even more exciting. 1673, Phonergia Nova. This is the first ever study of acoustics, and it happens because someone claimed to have invented the ear trumpet, And Athanasius Kircher said, no way, I invented the ear trumpet, and here are all the other things I invented that make noises or involve noises, and all the other things that anyone has ever invented that make noises, like the Aeolian harp. And also, I invented speaking automatons, and here are the plans, so back off, guy. 1675, he publishes a study of Noah's Ark. I think this is one of the things where his publisher is saying, could we get something with a little, you know, zhuzh to it? They love the Hollow Earth. Can we do something that everyone loves? So he did Noah's Ark. Runs the math, says, according to the dimensions of the Bible, Noah's Ark is plenty to hold all the animals. That is a Protestant lie. What would the feeding times be like? What would the schedule have been like on Noah's Ark? Let's work this out. And people will say, haters will say, that you can't fit all the animals on Noah's Ark. And he says, well, you don't know that when animals left Mount Ararat and went to new climates, they changed. And so deers, when they went to Finland, became reindeers. And leopards, when they went to Africa, became lions. So I guess maybe you're the person who's wrong, not the Ark. And then he did another book about the Sphinx, Sphinx Mystagoga, which also included deciphering a bunch of mummy cases that had shown up in Rome and refuting metempsychosis and reincarnation. Somewhere in here, he also just writes a book to order for a Spanish noble in which he just takes the noble's genealogy, which he'd sent him, and rewrites it fancier and talks about how great he is. I don't include that, but it's the kind of work that he was doing to bring the money in for the church.
Freelancing is like that.
1679 is the sequel to Noah's Ark. It's the Tower of Babel. He studies the Tower of Babel and proves that Nimrod was not just hubristic, but he was a bad scientist because there's not enough stone in the earth to build a tower all the way, even to the moon, much less to heaven. So take that, Nimrod. Also, if he'd built it, it would have flipped the earth over and killed everyone. So it's a good thing that God did that. But while we're talking about the Tower of Babel, and you can see his publisher shaking his fists, let's talk about architecture and the principles of architecture. And also let's talk about linguistics and the 72 root languages and how they all come from Hebrew. That'd be fun, wouldn't it? And you can just imagine the guy in Holland banging his head. Oh, we could have had one. In 1680, he dies, no doubt full of books unwritten, but his heart is buried in the Church of St. Eustace that he had discovered, so it is as happy an ending as you can have for a Jesuit during the 30 Years' War, and as you say, at the beginning of the Enlightenment, when everyone is saying, you know, let's not do that.
So, there are MacGuffins aplenty. The previously described ship-destroying mirror, I think, is something that you could chase in pretty much any subsequent era. Also, building one of his automatons, the ones that talk, I think are interesting, because if you build one, or if your mysterious recluse uncle builds one and it kills him in his old rambling house in New England and you have to go see what happens, we would, I think, be pretty interested in what that automaton had to say, because possibly you're feeding dialogue into it and it's just saying pre-programmed things, but what if it has other revelations to make? And of course, like any prolific writer who talked about a lot of different things, the idea of a missing chapter or missing book that gives away the real deal, starting with the previously mentioned real translation of the Voynich manuscript, could all be things that you are either pursuing or pursuing the terrible ramifications of once they get opened up and read.
And certainly if you're a book hound, his books are valuable because of these beautiful illustrations. They're also valuable because of their age. Many of them, as I say, were bestsellers, so there's lots of copies out there. But you can easily imagine a variant of the Mundus Subterraneus that has Kenyan in it, or Red Litten Yoth, or any of the other cool Lovecraftian underground things. You can even put Rulier in it, because he also talks about how all the world's oceans funnel into the North Pole and spit out the South Pole. So you've got Rulia, and now the elder things can show up. So he definitely, he's sitting at the center, literally, of the entire Jesuit intellectual enterprise. So anything that is found that is weird or occult or strange or mythosy, from Paraguay to Nagasaki, is going to make its way to his desk. So if you're looking for a guy to give you your marching orders, even in a 17th century Cthulhu game, Athanasius Kircher is quite the guy. Or maybe Athanasius Kircher's secretary that the Pope has bought him to give him more time to write books. And you show up at the Museum Kirkiriana, and you're shown a weird artifact that is crazily mythosy, and you're told, go check it out, find out what's going on. The Pope is backing your play with the whole Fortune of the Vatican. And that would be a fun game all by itself. And if you want to play that, I very much recommend a book that I leaned on a bit for this, Athanasius Kircher's Theater of the World, His Life, Work, and the Search for Universal Knowledge by Jocelyn Godwin, friend of the pod, even though he doesn't know it, because he is the best thing in the world, a good historian who also believes a lot of this nonsense. And so therefore, his book on Kircher is amazing. And as a book on Kircher should be, beautifully illustrated.
Well, once we come to the bibliography, we must be at the end of our podcast, but we'll be back next week with more of the similar. Stuff having once again been talked about, it's time to thank our sponsors.
Atlas Games.
Pelgrane Press.
Arc Dream.
Flagbearer Games.
Dark Tower.
And Pro Fantasy Software.
Music, as always, is by James Semple.
Audio editing by Rob Borges.
Support our Patreon at patreon.com/CanAndRobin.
Keep this podcast from losing its marbles alongside such backers as
John Bisco,
Matt Farr,
Mike Coleman,
Thomas Edward,
and Tristan Knight.
Wear this show or drink it from a mug with Ken and Robin merch at kenrobin.dashery.com.
Celebrate your joy of missing out with our latest design, Jomo.
On X, he's at Kenneth Height.
And on Blue Sky, he's robindlaws.bisky.social.
See you next time when, once again, we will talk about stuff.